All right, I'm here for the Midweek Pod with Wayne. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm all right. Great. I've got nothing about United to complain about. You've covered the weekend grumbles.
Yeah.
So all is fine and done.
That's it. Problem is with upping the amount of content you do is you've got to find something new to talk about. So I don't know whether people caught it, but me and Dan did our first of what we think is going to be a regular-ish daily pod just for YouTube. Same format, just a conversation. We haven't gone Goldbridge yet. Of which we will talk about more, I think, shortly. But we think we'll do it Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, mix of the usual crew, maybe some new faces too. But regular Sunday and Wednesday pods, or maybe Thursday pods if we're in the Conference League next season. But it means
that's my shift. I know that's my shift. God.
Gonna give way in the Conference League. Yeah, well, I expect you to know deeply about FC Karabag or HJK Helsinki or whatever Latvian side we might play or the Faroe Islands' third best team.
Yes, thank you. Can't wait. I shall commence studying with vigour.
Yeah. The professionalism I expect from all your content.
I can tell you some stuff. We've played Helsinki before. George Best played out there. It was the European Cup or UEFA Cup back in the day. Was it UEFA Cup back in the day? Fairs Cup.
Yeah.
So a lot of research to be done. I can't wait if we get into that most cherished of tournaments. I mean, I even know the theme tune now. It's like da 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 da. You know, everyone can do the Champions League one, but I know the Europa one.
Is there a different one for the Conference League? Because we're actually more likely to end up in the Conference League. Is there a different jingle?
Yeah, I've not sunk myself that low yet, and we could be there. Can you imagine if we're there and if we celebrate, if we won it and then celebrate it in the same manner that Mourinho did? As if like it was the celebration that came with that was like it's a clean sweep of everything in Europe, but that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing, is it? I mean, it wasn't a good thing that we played in the UEFA Cup with Rota Volgograd. They're not good things. There's an elite. There's an elite, and then there's bad European experiences. And
really bad European experiences. Well, we may well get the opportunity to add to our collection of European trophies. Well, we didn't win the Intertoto. You remember that one? I don't know. Yep, we didn't actually compete in it. Or the Anglo-Italian Cup, Do you remember when that...
No. We did compete in that.
We did?
Yeah, in the early 70s. This is the gold that you have me on for. So early in the 70s, when we were dead rubbish in this, like, you know, the post-European Cup era, we, just before we were relegated, so it's the Busby, McGuinness, O'Farrell era. Doherty might have even been manager at that point. But there was a point... like very early 70s, we played a couple of games, like Verona, I think, was one of the teams we played against. The reason why it's of interest is that the club don't count them as official games. Now, obviously, down the leagues, when other teams played them, because it was quite popular when the Italia Galazzo was shown in the, you know, in the early 90s, it was like, oh, if you played in the Anglo-Italian Cup, it was kind of cool in the lower divisions. Now, United did play this in the early 70s. They didn't win it. But Bobby Charlton played a couple of games and he scored a couple of goals in there, maybe just one goal. But the appearance and the goal, they don't count on his official record. So even though he did play more than 758 times for United, it doesn't actually don't count that. And there are some historians, the cool people I hang out with, who really don't like that they think that should be... It's in there with the... I'll tell you other things, Ed. I can tell you so interested. Other statistical anomalies of the past that we would like to rectify, such as David Beckham scoring a goal in the 1999 Charity Shield that was credited to Dwight Yoke because Beckham's free kick crosses the line and all the technology is there to give that goal to David Beckham, but it's Dwight Yoke's instead. It's not fair. It should be Beckham's goal. You know, interesting things like this you can find out in my book.
These things could matter at the end of the day when the history judges players and the statisticians that are following it and the historians.
On a storytelling narrative, in that perspective, it does matter, the Bobby Charlton thing, because if he clocks up 760 appearances, then Ryan Giggs isn't matching it when he scores the goal against Wigan in 2008. He isn't surpassing it when he wins the European Cup. It doesn't. There's no emotional resonance to that. Other than him getting closer to it. Do you know what I mean? It has some resonance now, because you look back, you say, oh, we passed the record, like we won the treble on Matt Busby's birthday. All these things have a certain romance about them. But you eliminate that if you go back and if you do the records bloody right.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Beckham. He got over 100 caps for England, but more than half of those were friendlies. But we count those at international level and not club level. It's wrong, I tell you. Mm-hmm. I'm wrong. Anyway, I did enjoy when the Anglo-Italian Cup was revived in the 90s and it just all kicked off. And all the fans of Birmingham City and Lazio Ultras were going at each other or whatever it was. I'm making that up, but actually it feels kind of right. It might well have been. So, all right. We are going to get on to United's FA Cup semi-final against Coventry City. I remembered who it was eventually in a little bit, but we're taking the news of the week. Dan and I talked about the under-18s winning the Premier League North, and they've got the Premier Cup against Manchester City next week to come, the all-conquering under-18 side. So once again, many congratulations to those guys. Elsewhere in United land, what's been going on? It's been a little quiet this week, hasn't it? We haven't had a player kicking off. We haven't had some drama about it. I don't think we've got any fresh injuries. I don't know.
No, not yet. Maybe we might have some returnees. We never know ahead of Sunday's game. Yeah, quiet. But I mean, it was a good achievement by it. But there's one thing we've got. You know, we can always talk about the credibility of having the youth system in terms of the historical value of it, but it is actually doing pretty good things at the moment. You know, there's a lot of good talent coming in there. It's the healthiest part of the club, you would say, really. And the best thing about, I mean, individual by individual, you can never tell completely, but the best thing about that environment at the moment is it seems a really good breeding ground for composure. Whether you've seen the players come into the first team, by and large, and I'm not picking on Kambola for what happened at the weekend, because I think he was let down by players around him. But by and large, the composure of players coming into the first team, which is one of the major things that you look for, has been very, very sound. So you've got to credit the environment that those players are going at. You. And all right, his ceiling is still unknown. He's still peaks and troughs to be seen with him, but his temperament in that first team has been proven. So obviously that's coming from somewhere, and that to me suggests that for the first time in a long time, the stability that we've got in that environment through Nick Cox and the people around him only deserves the highest of praise, because it's in tune with what the club is renowned for. And that, in a climate where we analyse everything else and we wonder how far it is from the identity of the club, that is very true to it, and that's very good.
Yes, and it hasn't always been true under the Glazer family. I mean, there was definitely a period where this was underfunded, ignored, the structure wasn't right. We had some clash of personalities, Nicky Butt and John Merton, not getting on and so on. But, I mean, I don't know Nick at all, but the sense I get from his social media presence and interviews and stuff like that is he just gets it. He has the club at heart and he knows what their job is. It's to produce, eventually, fine footballers. Hopefully some of them make the first team. If not, they have careers elsewhere. If they're able to, I mean, he said this yesterday, didn't he? He said, our job isn't to win necessarily in the under-18s, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the pressure of finding a winning team is also part of the development process, right? So there's no bad thing. The under-18s winning 19 of their 22 games so far this season and winning the league very comfortably.
I do know Nick, and I can tell you that, first of all, results are like a secondary issue. They're a consequence of a good environment. So, and that's United's philosophy as well. It's always been the historical philosophy, is that results are a secondary thing. It's the development, first and foremost. So they've concentrated on that. So the results were a byproduct, but we've seen a very healthy response to that. What I can tell you about Nick is, without labouring too long about it, is that he believes passionately about the, I guess you could call it a vocation, that he understands the privilege of the position that he's in and the lineage that he's following. He's very, very careful to make sure that he's faithful to that lineage right back to when it started. He's very aware of it. I really, really, and maybe I'm just saying it because I do know him and I've talked to him about this, that I think it feels really like the club is in the safest stance it's been for a long time in that environment. It's really, and it's good to see. All right, you can say it's great to see Cobby coming in. It's great to see Kambwala even playing, even though he made that mistake. It's obviously great to see Garnacho. But what is great to see is the environment is there. And yeah, long may that continue.
Yeah. Well, my $9.99 that I spent on MUTV, well worth it to catch some of those games. I don't know whether you know about this. I mean, life hack, but you can spend that much per month to get MUTV. But if you subscribe to it via the App Store on your phone, you can still use the same login credentials to get it on your telly. So anyway, $9.99 a year. Bargain content, that is, if you want to watch the under-23s or the under-18s and the various documentaries, which you may have been involved in some of that. So all good stuff. All right. That's the youth team. Good luck in their Premier Cup game coming up against the devil that is Manchester City, who unfortunately City are going to win the under-23s league or Premier League 2, I think they call it, again this year because they harvest talent. We had some interesting developments on the media front this week that we were going to talk about. So kind of contrasting things. Some controversy about the tone that some very prominent fan channels take. And at the same time, Henry Winter being fired by The Times, one of the most storied and respected and old school journalists on football in the country. And I know you had some thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people wouldn't. They don't think that deeply about it, but I think we're from a generation that would pick up a newspaper to read a match report, and
yeah,
you would always be able to tell who were the well-written ones. Even from a younger age, you'd be like, oh, this. You might find something entertaining in the tabloids, but you would tend to gravitate. If you wanted to understand football seriously, there were a few people that you would read. I'm going back to the 90s when he was still a prominent writer at that time. I'm talking about Paddy Barclay and Henry Winter were always seen as the two. Brian Glanville's a little bit earlier than that, but
yeah,
Winter and Barclay were the ones, weren't they? He said they're the thinking persons, journalists. If you want to understand football, if you want to feel a bit snobbish about yourself, you want to feel like you're the higher class of intellect understanding about football, you read Winter and you read Barclay. I still think that's true today. Obviously, Paddy's retired and Henry's, obviously, you said fired. Right? I prefer made redundant because that's what was the official term. Fired seems so much more brutal. I guess it's
very sorry. I didn't mean to insinuate any wrongdoing on Winter's part. Not saying he's a wrong end or anything like that, but yeah.
But we've got a generation of reporters. I'm talking like journalists and reporters. So, obviously, they're all journalists, they're all trained journalists, but I think the distinction that I'm saying when I'm talking about people who are beautiful writers as opposed to people who are great journalists, like Dan Taylor, who's a great writer and also a fantastic journalist, Adam Crafton, magnificent journalist, and probably the generation that's in front of him, he will establish that reputation even more. He's moved to New York, hasn't he? Moved to the US, and just he deserves all of that. But I'm talking about genuine top-class writing. It was always Paddy. Paddy's number one for me anyway, but Emery's like a close second because the way they write. And all right, I think over the years, people can take... If you're going to do a spitting image take on a football journalist, you'd probably take off Emery Winter's flowery style. And his love of puns and everything like that. But I think like there's also a place for that, and you know it's part of what he does. And the important thing about the integrity of some sporting journalists is, and we're talking, I know you're going to talk about the climate of modern media. In Henry Winter, you're talking about someone who's traveled the world, he's seen football in multiple different countries, he's spoken to coaches of different nationalities. Outside of the arena of people who are in football in terms of they are either coaches or players or they're involved in football clubs, he is as knowledgeable as anybody around the world in terms of football. So he knows what he's talking about. You wouldn't, if you wanted a panelist outside of a football club to talk about football, you're not going to get much better than Henry Winter. You're not going to get someone with much more credibility than that. And I would always listen to his opinion on him. He's got his finger on the pulse when it comes to fan matters. Even this season, he's talked about, you know, United's issues with their ownership and everything like that. And he knows what he's talking about. He's not off the beat. You look at him, you don't think you're out of touch. You don't know what you're talking about. He does know what he's talking about. And that's a skill to be able to do that across multiple different football clubs.
Yeah.
By someone who consumes the sport and loves the sport. Now, and I'm talking about that really, I mean that in a sincere and earnest way. Like, that's the highest compliment I can give someone, is that if they're neutral and I look at their writing, I think, all right, I don't mind what you're writing about my football club, even if it's critical, because you understand and respect their knowledge of the game as a whole. I don't understand football as a whole. I'm a great lover of the game and everything like that, but my specialism is in the club that I support, because that's what I focus most of my time on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same for a lot of people. I think most people, even in the media, and if you talk even like local beat reporters, like the MEM reporters, they concentrate on Manchester United or Manchester City. Their knowledge of football as a whole might be better than the average person, because they're still trained journalists and everything like that, but they're still not anywhere near the level of a Henry Winter. And that's even, I'm talking still in the school of journalists before you talk about modern media and the people that now go on Sky Sports, apart from Andy, obviously, or other people who've been associated with this podcast who've been on media and everything like that. People who've got a good background in that arena. But then there are people who aren't, and people who will be given credibility by mainstream media. And there's such a massive disconnect in the understanding of the game and the understanding of the issues to being angry.
I can't stress
that enough for anyone who listens to this. The disconnect, the level of intellect and understanding of the game is so vast that it might as well be a completely different sport.
I do think it's interesting, because modern media landscape's obviously changed, and the internet has democratized the ability to produce content. Oh, we benefit as well, because you do a couple of different podcasts and I do this one, and it's very easy to record, produce, publish, very low cost and decent quality, right? Especially in audio. And so
we hope.
Well, aside from the occasional audio and video fuck-ups, which happen now and again, and my challenges with getting Dan to sit close to the microphone so his sound doesn't go in and out. Dan, if you're listening, well done, mate. You're getting better. But for the most part, it's very easy to do, and that has allowed a whole range of people to build audiences. And at the same time, traditional media is fighting for that same audience. Right? So if you're the Times and you employ Henry Winter on a very healthy salary, you know, he deserves it and all of that, right? Not quibbling with that, but you employ these traditional journalists, you're still fighting with The Athletic for subscriptions, or with FAMCAN channels for attention time, or with blogs. For years and years and years, I wrote thousands of articles on the United Rant blog for free and just gave them away, right? And at one stage, I had a very, very large audience. And you're just like, well, in a sense, I was competing with traditional journalists. No, I didn't. I wasn't trained journalist, and I definitely didn't do any journalism, right? I didn't investigate anything. I didn't uncover anything. I didn't interview people very often, now and again. It was just opinion stuff. But it's all competing for the same audience. And so traditional media know that as well. And so they start to be sort of followers, not necessarily fast followers, but a bunch of them start to do more tactics stuff. They hadn't done that before, really, outside of match reports. Now they do. Or more fan-oriented stuff, or more video stuff. And they have to compete. But I do think even in that environment, there is a place for people like Henry Winter and other old school journalists who do the legwork of building relationships and uncovering stories and having that broad view and being able to cover the game as a whole, and certainly as an antidote to blokes shouting into a camera and calling players four letter words. Definitely the antidote to that.
But also, it's the craft of writing as well. I'm talking to someone who like I say, I read so much when I was younger. Those writers I'm talking about, you know, like Danny Taylor. Like now we can engage with these people on social media when they were just names on the, before they were names on the newspaper, and you're like, oh my God, he's written something here that's great. I'm going to pick up the next issue to read what he says because it connected. It was something, especially when it was a good writer. And those things, like the match reports, like I've got one of these old, it's like a, it's, I think it's actually the Daily Mirror, but the old A4 newspaper books that they sort of like, they print out like a bunch of memories that are famous headlines of the club that you support, and you can get them for multiple ones. It was a gift, and it's great, and there's some great old writing in there. For a lot of my research, well, for every book that I've ever done, I've got folders and folders of physical and digital papers of columns from going back to the 19th century talking about Newton and Heath, and then the 20th century talking about Manchester United and sports writers through the generations. And United have been lucky because there's been a number of them. A couple of them were obviously killed in Munich as well. And then, the, you know, like David Meek, the local ones. And then you go on to people like Paddy. And what the point I'm trying to make in a long-winded way is that back in the 90s, when you watch a game and you enjoyed the game, and then the next morning, you didn't have YouTube. I don't know, I'm not doing the old person kind of thing here, but what I'm talking about is your memory of the game could also, you'd relive some of it by reading the match report. And if it was a well-written match report, or if the analysis was good, or if an interview was good. I remember Paddy Barclay did one of the first interviews with Cantona just around the time that we signed him. And it was like, it was so good. And they did another one with Fergie just after that, speaking about it on an intellectual level, and it was so good. I was only like, you know, at the time I was only 12, but you know, you're reading, you're like, oh, that's interesting, and they're using vocabulary that you don't know. You know what I mean? You have to go and look up words, extend your own vocabulary, and you feel like you're becoming more intelligent by extension. That you grew up with these people educating you in that way. You don't get that experience. Like I said, it's four letter expletives. It's not the same kind of thing. You don't think, after watching any game this season, to take your fancy, you don't think, oh, I watched Liverpool get knocked out of the FA Cup and then I turned on a fan channel. Even one of our podcasts that we do, and enjoy, like, hopefully people do enjoy what we say and do, but it's not something that will stay there as like a, in 10 years' time, you'll remember the podcast that you listened to after.
What are you talking about? What is, of course, no. Good. No, they don't. The funny thing is, on a few occasions, the podcast has moved from different servers to servers. It always used to be hosted on my own server, and then Apple would draw from there. And then when we changed the name of the podcast and moved to Global, the media company, we had to move everything over. And I could have just started again, but I spent dozens of hours moving it, so I had an archive of it all. And now we're hosted by Acast, and I've still got the archive. Like, no one's going to go back and listen to episode 27 or whatever. But it's still there as an archive. So,
Ed, don't conflate the point I'm making here, because I've got that on mine as well. I've got like 300 odd episodes, nowhere near as long as yours, but it's still been running a few years. And people do go back and listen to the older episodes, particularly if you've done special feature episodes for whatever reason. I've gone back and listened to old episodes of different podcasts for research purposes to say, like, such and such said this on this podcast at this time, because it's a good reference point to go back and do that, especially when they are features or special interviews and things like that, because they're of the time, they're important, and they are documented in the mood as it is at the time. Now, that's a different thing to say, all right, you could still do that. Maybe in 10 years' time, the journalists of the time will be doing that, coming back to podcasts and saying, what was the fan mood at the time? Let's listen to a couple of podcasts and see. But I just don't think with that.
No, I think
with
most of it's thrown away.
So. Yeah, especially with the daily stuff, like with the bigger fan channels, the ones that really feed off this kind of, like, basically hate in the moment, those ones, and they feed off that happening on a daily basis, then that eventually fizzles out. Either those people get themselves cancelled and the old lot gets deleted, or it happens so fast that either the offensive thing that they've said will get deleted, they'll change that from the live stream to when it goes out, so the context is different, and all those kind of things. They're manipulating it to their own image, and they're just not things that you're going to go back and say. But mostly because when we watch, for example, I'm sure we've both enjoyed doing it, like watching the Arsenal one when they would lose. When they thought they were getting somewhere and then they'd lose.
Oh, yeah.
Those ones.
Car crash stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was beautiful to watch, but you're not going to go back and look at them again unless they pop up viral on the thing, but you're not going to pop it up. It's not going to make any. There's no intellectual weight to it. There's no premise in carrying that forward into another generation and saying that's worth documenting other than a social experiment. There's nothing like, whereas Henry Winter's journalism, just to bring it on the... it sounded like I've gone a long way away from Henry Winter, but back to Henry Winter. His report, his analysis of the game will be read by future generations, and people will read that writing and they'll say, this is beautifully written sports journalism, as you will Paddy's, going back to the early 80s, yeah. As you will David Lacey in The Guardian.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's really going to go back to a 2003 report on Sheffield Wednesday versus Burnley and go, oh, yes, remember the days. But I don't know. But the archive is there, and I a lot of it will stand the test of time. And I think you're right that most modern, especially fan-produced or quasi-fan-produced, because some of them are actually funded by professional media companies. I think a lot of that stuff is just totally throwaway. I do like some of it. I have a love-hate relationship with some styles of modern fan media. So I read a lot of the tactics people, the data people. Sometimes they cross over, not always. And I like the insight that people who take the time to learn stuff, interview people, present it in a way that's digestible and it's adding something new, which for the most part, modern media companies don't do. There's little bits of it, but modern media is still all bantery at the moment, with exceptions, a few exceptions. So I like that. And I kind of have a love-hate relationship. The hate part is, fuck me, some of these people don't half give off incel vibes. Like, interact with humans now and again and don't be absolute twats, which I have to say about 90% of them are. But they produce some good stuff, aside from the twattishness. But the shouting into the camera and calling the manager a cunt or whatever, I just don't understand the value of that. But it gets really big audiences, so I'm an old man shouting into clouds about that, apparently. We both are, Wayne.
Yeah. No, yeah, I do accept that. There is a bit in that sort of arena of you saying there's things that are forgettable. There is, I get that, yes, someone might not go back and read a Sheffield Wednesday versus Burnley match report, but they should sometimes because there's an occasional gem in there. There was one after a United game in the 84-85 season, just after we'd signed Gordon Strachan. And it was John Coles in The Guardian. And he said, Strachan, Olsen, Whiteside, and I'm going to say Stapleton because I don't think he said Robson. He said that United have never had a better quartet. He was speaking in the context of referencing Best, Lowe and Charlton. So they were in that good a run of form that he was sort of saying, they're going to be even better.
Whiteside, Stapleton, and
yeah, exactly. But I mean, look, don't get me wrong. Like, Whiteside was a fantastic player, and if he'd not got the injuries, he would have been. He probably would be in the conversation for one of the greatest ever. But what I mean is, it's good to have those kind of things to look back on because they are notable by the tone of the mood at the time. And that John Coase was a great writer. It's like we were saying on the last time I was on with Rob. Like, he made one infamous. Like error of judgment, like for his normal judgment is magnificent. I love talking to him about football because he knows what he's talking about. He gets everything so right, but like people are generally known in the football punditry world, the more prominent ones for the error of judgment, aren't they? Like Alan Hansen and everything like that, even though one seemed sound at the time. So they're good things to go back and reference because if you're a great writer and occasionally you get something wrong or at least tests the mood at the time, even if it's an over-exaggeration, those are good things to go back and look at. You don't say, oh, Bruno was the worst captain to ever wear the United shirt. Do you know what I mean? Those kind of things. But we just said today, because it's like the kind of, today it's the shock of what you're saying, isn't it? It's the shock, first of all, the language that you use and the shock of what you're saying.
Ability to get viral as well, cause outrage.
Yeah. Anyway,
our videos don't go viral, Wayne. We're not causing enough outrage.
I don't think I've done. Yeah,
I don't think we're ever going to get there. We're not the types. I did at one stage. Daniel Taylor, who you referenced, mentioned some stuff I said about Fergie in one of his books. And this is the one. I was not that polite about Fergie during the 2004-05 season. Anyway, so I'm for all time in that book. Thanks, Daniel.
Right, I'm going to go and find that out. I've got it on my shelf somewhere. I'm going to...
I'm in there. I can't remember what page. Not my finest hour, but, you know, whatever. The other time he got in touch for a line, I was watching the John Terry, Anton Ferdinand trial.
Yeah.
And it was hilarious, the transcript as it was coming out and people were reporting on it, because there was a lot of confusion in what John Terry had said and when, and the arguments were about, like, what did he call him and at what point? And there was confusion with, he called him a cunt. Well, he called him more than that. And then there was a debate between Ferdinand and Terry about who's the cunt? You're the cunt. I'm the cunt. No, you're the cunt. And it just struck me as being like that scene in Trainspotting where Begbie beats up the guy in the pub and the two punters there go, we knew that cunt was going to fuck some cunt. And sorry for the listeners who don't like the swearing. I've said the C word about 75 times in a row there, but it's in context. Yeah. And Daniel Taylor dropped into the inbox and he was like, can I use that line? And he butchered it in his piece. And I was like, no, you didn't get it right. Oh, got the quote wrong. But yeah, anyway, there you go. That again, probably for all time.
Okay, if I can just do an overriding closing statement on all of that. Just all of it is to say that the modern outrage nonsense that we've just talked about should never be legitimized at the side of a writer like Emery Winter or a journalist like Adam Crafton or Daniel Taylor. It should never take the place of it. And I know you said earlier there's still a place for Emery Winter. That's not the point. The point is that his should always be the place. Now, Emery Winter, I don't know how old he is, but I'm going to say, let's say, for the argument's sake, 60 years old. So, and I'm not being morbid about this. You appreciate the writers while you've got them, and then they'll shuffle off this mortal coil and whatever, but then they'll be ours for generations. No,
Henry, if you're listening, Wayne is predicting your imminent demise.
Not imminent. What I mean is, like, they'll be there for a while, but then who will follow Henry? I'm definitely not putting myself in that category, and I'm not a broadsheet writer anyway. But who's in that next generation of writers who writes like Henry? So it's all right mocking him like Jonathan Lynn did in The Guardian today. It's all right, like, and I know a lot of it was loving, but it was still kind of mocking, like saying Henry, you're part of yesterday's press, and he's not. He's still a prominent part of today's press, and there's no one who even touches him in terms of quality of writing. So you can have your little dig at him, but unless you can point to the next person who was there to say that person adequately replaces him, or he's a follower, he's a natural follower, and he's going to be the person who you read instead of Emre, then what you're actually saying is it's a loss to the game and we don't mind. It's still a loss to the game, and what we've got in its place is not any good. And I think you can legitimize, people can legitimize what we've got now as whatever is the progress in the future and everything like that. But for me, it's not. And I think over the next 10 years, if you see a progressive loss of writers, the standard of Henry, or not quite as good as Henry, but good writers nonetheless, then the game will be poorer for it. It'll be massively poorer for it.
Yeah, I agree. I do think, and look, I don't know the financials exactly, but I do think outlets like The Athletic, just to reference them, and the platform that they've given Adam and others to do great journalism, shows there is still an appetite for long form, in-depth, investigative news breaking, analysis, and journalism. So there's still an outlet for that. And that's not to say us old fogies only like that. I think good quality writing is good quality writing, and there will always be good quality writers. And we just hope that, like, the finances of the media market allow those people to have a platform, and it isn't completely obliterated by how cheap it is to put a couple of people either in front of a camera like us or in a small studio and shout at a camera, because that is really cheap. And the economics of that are probably very good with 2 million subscribers, low cost to produce and high profitability margins, I imagine. So that will determine a lot of what the media landscape looks like, I hope. That and AI, where it's very hard to tell the difference between a human and a computer writer. It's already used in very large swathes of the media to do breaking news, especially in financial markets. And it'll be coming to other stuff soon. And we I hope, not to sound too old, are able to protect the highest quality writers both from crappy content and from non-human writers, because both will be a challenge in the years to come. All right, very good. Well, that was a good rant on media stuff. I wasn't expecting to talk for half an hour about that, but all good. That's what you come to us for. United have a game this weekend.
Oh, yes.
Coventry City, the mighty Coventry City, who are currently very, very, very close to making it to the Premier League last year, weren't they? Which would have been perhaps an even more remarkable story than Luton making it. I'm not sure. They're now sort of about top half of mid-table in the Championship, so not had as strong a season. They probably won't make the playoffs, almost certainly won't. But given the challenges that club has had, I think Mark Robbins is still doing a very good job in keeping them there. They've been in and out of their own stadium. It's not their own stadium anymore.
Yeah.
They had to go and play Northampton for a while. They've played in Birmingham. They played at Burton for a couple of games when they have this fairly new stadium, which they got kicked out of and they couldn't agree rent, and it was owned by the city, and then it's now owned by Mike Ashley. So not sure that bodes well for the future. But yeah, interesting club that's had a fantastic run to the semi-finals.
Yeah, I did a little bit of work at Coventry at the start of last year, and I saw their right back came up to me and he's like, oh, they talk about United. He said, is there any chance that you could get me signed by United? I was like, oh, yeah, all right. We could probably do with that right back now, considering we don't have one that's currently worthy of the description. Well, there didn't seem to be one playing on Saturday, unfortunately.
Not anywhere near the space on the pitch where they should have been, anyway.
Yeah. Not next to Kambwala, which is normally where you would expect to see one. Anyway, that grumble aside, no. It's been funny because throughout this cup run, so obviously we started at Wigan and then Newport, every time we scored in the cup run as a joke, I was tweeting every single goal was, oh, that goal could be Ten Hag's Mark Robbins moment, right? I'm saying that every single goal, even when the Newport, we scored a few goals, and I kept saying it. And I think the third time, I you know what I'm like, flog a dead horse. By the fourth goal, it was getting hilarious to me, just carry on. Because I thought then people would get the joke, but they didn't seem to. They kept thinking that I was being serious about it. But then we got to Forest, and then Casemiro scored, and I tweeted it again. That time is fairly serious because that's like that was a Mark Robbins goal. That's exactly what he did. And then we get a quarterfinal with Diallo scoring, which could turn out to be a Mark Robbins goal, save Ten Hag's job. And now we're actually playing against Mark Robbins. I've been having this conversation with a couple of people this week. I think like the footballing gods, if you're up there, please listen to me. I can't have, and we're talking now while City are playing Real Madrid, so I have no idea of the outcome of the tie. But the idea of City winning two trebles and us losing the FA Cup final to them both times, I don't know what the odds are against them. It couldn't be that cruel. So I'm investing all of my hope and faith in the idea that we've got this Mark Robbins theme going on, and I'm going to be at Wembley, so I won't be tweeting. But I will tweet after if we have a Mark Robbins-esque goal. Maybe Mark Robbins will go on the pitch himself and score the bloody goal.
He should register himself in the squad, shouldn't he, just to do it, yeah. Did you see Romario has registered himself as a player again, age 58? I think he's older than Mark Robbins, so there you go.
Was he really?
Yeah.
What a man.
Mark is, let's say he doesn't look in the best shape of his life right at the moment. So
I don't know. I wouldn't back him.
5 minute cameo.
I wouldn't back him to play 90. I wouldn't back me to play 90, Mark. So I'm not criticizing you. We're in the same boat as former professionals. No. Okay.
All former professionals. At what is a different question?
Yeah. I was going to say I'm a former professional something, but not a former professional footballer. I could still back Mark to give our defense a rough time, though, if you give him 10 minutes. I'm sure of that. No, whether or not he does register himself to play, I'm sure. Surely, we've got enough to overcome Coventry. No, the one thing that I will say from seeing, I've seen two of the games in the cup run, I watched most of the Wolves game. Spirit goes a long way, and they've got that. It took them a long way last season. Like you said, they are punching above their weight in terms of the conditions that Mark's had to deal with. So we're the kind of opponent that is perfectly placed for Coventry to upset. We really are. And I think if the message doesn't get through... So my worry about our players is they're going to see this as like a comfortable 4-0 win, but all of them are going to be looking for a goal from 30 yards. We've got all the forwards who try and do that sort of stuff. They were doing it against Newport. I don't know if you remember that, or if you've wiped it from your brain, but that's exactly the problem that we got ourselves into. Newport equalised, didn't they, just for off time, if I'm right? Because we were doing this, we were faffing about with it. We'll do that at Wembley. We'll do that because they're too predictable a team not to. And they'll know that because we're too predictable a team to play against. Now, the difference maker will probably be quality, probably. But that's the magic of the cup as far as they're concerned and the misery as far as we're concerned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good thing if you're a Coventry fan is you know you're going to get some chances because we give everyone chances, even Newport had several. Yeah. Maybe not our standard 25 shots against.
No, I was going to say, is that, are we still on the run of more than 20 a game for like 7 or 8 games?
Yeah.
Let's do our, rather than the result, rather because the result's no fun, really, because even if we predicted us to lose and we were right, it's still misery. Do you think that Coventry will get 20 shots against us?
No. Would you bet against it? Not any significant sum of money. I might put a fiver on it, but I'm not betting a house or a kidney or my firstborn.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we could definitely. I mean, look, if Casemiro plays and Coventry get around him, they will be able to isolate Mainoo and put pressure on the back four. That's what everyone else has done. Quick transitions as four of our forwards go press in this kind of completely headless fashion. It will allow us to be open. And then we got to hope that Willy Kambwala and Harry Maguire do some good box defending because we've had to do an awful lot of that this season. It's now Ten Hag's euphemism for we don't defend from the front very well. So, yeah, there's definitely opportunities. I mean, quality should tell. But we don't create that many chances either. We've been scoring. Let's say we've been scoring. It'd be nice to see Højlund get him a few more shots off. He barely shoots. And it's not his fault. He doesn't get the ball. We play into Ten Hag's system. It means that we play into the wide players, not into him. You could have anyone up there. It could be Wout Weghorst, maybe. But yeah, we don't play to his strengths, which is a real shame for him. Hopefully we do. I mean, there was that short period where he started getting goals. But he was getting goals well above his XG. He's like 25% above his own XG.
But also, I do feel in that period of time we'd learned to play with him in the side, and there was a little bit more proper service to him. Even if it was like not crossing in the conventional sense, he was more involved in the game because they were involving him more in the game. Now I don't know if with the form downturn and players have got a bit more individualistic and selfish, but all the players around him are the same ones, right? Do you know what I mean? They should be able to flick a switch and get it back on. There's no excuse. There's no excuse for how cut adrift he's been from the side and since his return. There's no excuse for it. Those same players were around him. So I would hope, Erik ten Hag, if you are listening to this, tell all those players that this week. Make that the message. Involve Rasmus more. Pass him the ball. Do the thing that Fergie allegedly told the players when Van Persie signed. If you don't pass him the ball, I'm not going to effing play you. He's in there to score the goals. I don't understand it, because it was something that was working. It was something that was working. Then again, if I did understand it, I wouldn't be sat here talking to you moaning about it. Unfortunately, I'd be there fixing it. But
well, yeah, I mean, to yeah. circle back on the conversation from earlier, you know, with the Tacticos, they all hate Erik ten Hag, all of them. Now, take it all with a pinch of salt. We have our own Darnish, who may or may not return. Hopefully he does. And a few others. But like, the analysis is all the same. And it will be from Coventry's tacticians. It will also be pointing out the very obvious flaws too. Right? So United have flaws. A lot of it comes from the manager. A lot of it comes from the players, some of whom are just remarkably dumb and don't stick to whatever plan, however flawed it is, they are being given. So a lot of that will still be true, because this is just United, but their quality should come through, clearly.
Yeah, but the other thing with that, with the tactical exposing, is that really, for teams of lesser ability, that's not a problem, because the things that you're exposing in United's system aren't to do with ability, they're to do with space and concentration. So if you've got the energy and you've got the application, like you said, because you know that Coventry will have that, because it's a big game for them, they're going to show that, and they will expose United at various times, because United are there to be exposed, and you know that they'll get chances. Yeah, all right, you could say it's whether or not they get the quality in those chances, but I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Sims doesn't ever look like he's the most natural finishers, but he finishes if you give him chances. Good striker will eventually, they will punish you, and we will give enough chances to be punished. So what I mean is that we can say something like, and I agree with the general premise, because it's what I said at the start, quality should tell. It doesn't necessarily have to, because we'll give them enough chances. Do you know what I mean? It's such a weird United side for that. Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like, when you watch it and you look at that game plan and you look how it can be exposed, and you say, you don't necessarily have to be better tactically, technically, than those players. You don't have to be. You can beat them in other ways. They can be beaten in other ways. It doesn't have to be technically. That's what they'll be saying, and it can be done. That's why we're sat here not speaking with any great confidence about it.
And that's mad, isn't it, playing a mid-table championship side? So, well, we'll see whether Erik gets his Mark Robbins moment and has a savior in this game. I mean, clearly it would be nice if we scored a couple of times in the first 5 minutes and we coast our way, and then Chelsea beat City in the other semi, which would be very nice. Thank you very much. I think that's about it for this episode. For YouTube viewers, we will probably be back on Thursday and maybe on Friday too. It's a short topic of the day. For the main podcast, I guess I will be back with Dan or Tom, can't remember who's on, after the Coventry game on Sunday night. You can also catch us on Patreon if you want to be a backer. We do an extra show each week. And on the socials, you are at Wayne S. Barton. I'm at NQATpod. You can find us on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Threads, on Instagram. I think that's about it. Thank you very much, everyone.